wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. This is KBOO Portland, Portland's listener-supported and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. Today in our program, Joe Clement and Kevin Duncan start a series of conversations about the societal lack of and need for political education in this country. I'll be sharing an article entitled, As the World Burns, Hurtling Towards an Unlivable Planet by Paul Street. Our Left in the Law commentators, Mike Snedeker and Jan Hawken, conclude our program today discussing the Giuliana versus United States government case, the civil lawsuit filed by 17 young people in Oregon against the U.S. government regarding the government's inaction on climate change. In our lead-off piece today, Bill Resnick interviews Rachel Haynes, a terrific second-grade teacher, a member of the Portland Association of Teachers Union, and who serves on the Environmental Education Board. The interview is in two parts to be played in consecutive weeks. Part one, today, discusses the challenges faced by elementary teachers without help in a classroom of often more than 30 students, and which requires them to do lots of standardized one-on-one student testing.
Rachel Haynes, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Bill.
Rachel Haynes is a second grade teacher at Glen Cole School in Southeast Portland. She's been there 8 years. She's a union activist and works with other teachers and community activists developing a climate change justice curriculum, which she's using much of it and hoping other teachers do. At least the group is, in fact, developing it for use by many teachers. I first encountered Rachel on YouTube giving testimony. It was in 2014 to the Portland School Board on the problems teachers and students face as resources for schools are continuously cut. Had she had more time, she would have also discussed several other issues of facing the schools. For one, the dreadful impact of standardized curriculums and standardized testing. For another, she would have discussed this alternatives and how to build schools that really engage children and provide an environment for developing a love of reading and learning and for developing values and social skills. We'll talk about that today. First, though, I'd like to play Rachel Haynes and her testimony.
My name is Rachel Haynes. Last name spelled H-A-N-E-S. I teach at Glencoe, and this year our first grade classes have between 33 and 34 students. Imagine teaching a room of 34 six-year-olds how to read. Class size impacts workload and student success. Teachers plan lessons, prep materials, develop assessments, fill out report cards, administer district and state mandated assessments, attend staff meetings and professional development. We communicate with parents, design and implement behavior plans, attend BSC and IEP meetings. We individualize instruction, teach whole class, small group, and one-on-one. The more students, the more work. I work 10-hour days, and it's still not enough. Every day, many of my colleagues' cars are still in the parking lot long after our contract day is over. We take work home, and we work on the weekends. Each year, our workload increases, and it gets more difficult to serve our students. The workload of psychologists and special education teacher impacts us all. As a former special education teacher, I know all too well the impossible and totally unrealistic demands placed on my colleagues. Currently, psychologists aren't able to identify, evaluate, and qualify students in a timely manner. Our psychologist is spread between several buildings and is at our school 1 day a week. In that time, she's expected to meet with parents and teachers to plan evaluations, test and observe students, meet to review test results, and attend IEP meetings for the entire building. A student I referred in the middle of last year wasn't assessed until well into this year because her calendar was so full. And this year, she is already booked into March. Students that have significant academic or behavioral struggles often have to wait a year or more to receive services. And then special education teachers often have caseloads so large there isn't enough time in the day to provide the legally required minutes of service on IEPs. Caseloads must be reduced, and psychologists must have scheduling and transfer protection so they can serve their students. The art of teaching involves so much more than what can be measured on a test. It involves building community, engaging students, understanding their strengths and weaknesses, motivating them to push beyond their limits, encouraging them to learn from their mistakes and persevere when challenged, and constant reflection and fine-tuning of our practice. Honor the dedication that we give every day to our students. Teachers are not simply FTE and dollars to shuffle around, just as our students aren't just test scores. It is in our power as a community to improve our schools. Let's lower class sizes. Let's invest our time, money, and energy into services that directly impact students. Let's listen to and collaborate with students, teachers, and families. Let's treat teachers as professionals with expertise and experience. Let's bring back course offerings that engage students and provide them with a well-rounded education. Let's stop judging students and schools on basis of standardized tests. Do the right thing for our district and settle a fair contract, because we will never stop fighting for the schools Portland students deserve.
So, Rachel, that was you 5 years ago. I know you remember it well.
I do.
So, Rachel, in that clip that we played, you went through issues basically of class size, and the classes are way too big for the kind of individualized, for really dealing with kids on a personal level, particularly probably the withdrawn kids or the fairly troubled kids, of which there are many, who need a lot of attention, and it's just impossible. And you don't have support staff either in the schools, and there are no other adults in your room, which is pretty remarkable. No aides. Sometimes some parents come. Does that happen very often?
A little bit. I mean, it becomes challenging, though, to try to manage a very full class and then adults that may or may not have teaching backgrounds. So I tend to not have parent volunteers because I find that to be an added planning that I just don't have time or space for. But yeah, I mean, the large class size, not just our kids coming in with different social skills and emotional skills that can be very different, but academically, often there are kids coming into second grade. I usually have a few to a handful of kids that, for a variety of reasons, are not reading yet, not writing at grade level, so really struggling with academic skills. And then on the flip side, there are kids that are reading and writing and doing math above the grade level. So it becomes the responsibility of the classroom teacher to differentiate and serve all those kids where they're at. So if you had a class of 17, that would be far easier than a class of 27, 29,
right.
30.
Yeah, you wrote, we exchanged emails, so I've got you on paper here. There are lots of kids coming to school with trauma, anxiety, disabilities, even those that qualify for special education services. You have a full-time counselor in the school for whatever it is, 360 children?
We do have a counselor, and honestly, depending on the level of need, she does in-classroom social-emotional teaching. That's a given. That just happens. But she also has groups for kids, like special groups for kids who are working on particular social skills or emotional skills. But often she and the principal and other support staff, like the school secretaries, are helping kids who are extremely dysregulated. So these are kids who are often so disruptive that teaching cannot occur or are a danger to themselves or others. And honestly, every year, the past few years, there have been at least one or two students that are requiring a lot of adult one-on-one attention. And because a classroom teacher cannot possibly do that, they get the support staff and the administrative staff. If they need to leave the room in order to keep themselves and others safe and go to the office, sometimes they're having their what I would call like a dysregulated episode. I don't know how you would phrase it.
That's one of those abstract words. Why don't you tell what it is?
Like out of control, out of control behavior, trying to attack adults, hit, punch,
ripping things off the walls, throwing things,
tearing things.
Really? What's the word for that? You have a word of art for when the rest of the class has to leave the room then. What's that word?
Oh, that's called a room clear.
Room clear.
And those are happening more and more frequently all over the state, actually. It's become an issue of kids who are so dysregulated, so out of control. I know I keep using that word. The reason I use dysregulated is because it is really a skill that they have not learned how to regulate their own emotions, their own behavior. And I think that's a more respectful kind of way to say it than they are like having a tantrum or are out of control. These are kids that have not learned, for whatever reason, how to manage their emotions, and they don't have the skills to do it.
Right. So, though sometimes the impulses are so strong that I guess people learn how to regulate, but in some ways you have to see some of that behavior as just a terrible neediness, that they aren't in emotional repose, that somehow they've not reached a place where they feel good on a constant basis, so that those, it seems to me it's a whole complex of things, and you can see it as a social skill, but you also have to see it as a failure of sort of creating environments where kids are peaceful and can and feel good about themselves.
I've had students like that in my class, and it's really complicated. I mean, basically, it is beyond the scope of what teachers are trained to do. And you know, I have deep empathy for kids who are in such distress that this is the only way they know how to express themselves.
Yeah, that's another way of looking at it, isn't
and
it?
And I've had students like this in my class, and it often takes like a majority of the year to gain their trust and to work with them in order to help them regulate. But honestly, like, some of them are so troubled that it starts again on some level with the next teacher, because it is like this. I think a lot of it has to do with feeling safe and knowing how to deal with feeling like you're in a state of anxiety or attack or fight or flight.
But you do, after you've had some successes with kids who began really dysregulated.
Yeah,
and very troubled, and they get right, they begin attaching to you and some of the other kids and feeling a lot better, right? Better, but then the next year,
I think part of it is, I mean, an emphasis, at least in my teaching in my class, there's a real emphasis on community. So I always talk about kids that don't have particular social skills or emotional skills, as that's their area that they have challenges, that they're trying to learn new behaviors, new skills, just like somebody who doesn't know how to read is trying to learn those skills, to learn how to read. So we really talk about it in a really inclusive way, that like, these are kids that are learning something, and we're all here to support each other in our learning.
Yeah. We all have troubles, but we all can support one another.
Yeah.
There's
a bit of like normalizing kids who are in mental health crisis, because this is their struggle, and we can help and support them the best we can.
You know, I remember reading Erik Erikson, the psychologist. Mm-hmm. In fact, he wrote about development. He talked about this in a couple of chapters of stuff he wrote. It's liberating to understand the universality of human troubles, that you're not the only mm-hmm. one, that everybody goes through it, and we should just help one another. That was sort of the message.
But I think that, you know, part of fostering that kind of community and relationships in your classroom goes against everything that standardization is trying to do, because when you're meeting kids where they're at, and when you're trying to help them grow and learn from their starting place, it's going to look different for every child. And no child is going to follow the same path or trajectory or even get the same learning from the same lesson. And so when you really value individual children and you really value building relationship in your classroom, it's the antithesis to standardization. You're working within the community that you have in your room.
And this is your Omo Variety Hour on KBOO. I'm talking to Rachel Haynes. Rachel's a teacher who's a teacher of teachers and who works with a community of teachers on a variety of things. You were talking about the standardization. Tell us a story about the standardization and the testing and the teaching to the test and the pressure on teachers and the pressure on students.
Yeah, you start kindergarten now. Before they even start in the classroom, every student is assessed on their kindergarten readiness.
Yeah.
So whether they know the alphabet, their numbers, can read any words. I mean, we are looking at a new level of... They love the word academic rigor, you know, politicians and policy people that have nothing to do with the classroom. But academic rigor, they're expecting that in kindergarten. So kindergarten used to be a place where you're starting to learn your alphabet and to read a little bit, write a little bit, and you have snack,
look at
you play.
Pictures, talk. Deal with other children.
Yeah, lots of social skill building. And now it's largely academic. And
it's largely academic.
Yes. And
how could that be? What do? They count numbers? They do the alphabet?
They're expected.
Phonetics?
Yeah. And there's a standard, there are benchmarks for learning that they're supposed to achieve by the end of kindergarten.
In kindergarten, this starts.
Yes, it does start in kindergarten. And I think that there's so little room now for creativity and the kind of real learning that happens when kids are given some room to explore and have some freedom and to be able to present a problem or some kind of project for kids to work through. There's less and less space. So even in second grade, most of our focus and emphasis is on reading, writing, and math. And we have set minutes that we're supposed to be teaching that, and very little science curriculum or kits or supports or anything to help with teaching that.
Not much social studies, not much literature. This is, I would think, I mean, I know now Portland teachers have fought and finally won in their contract the right to bring in other materials. But of course, then there's the principal and the sort of...
Right.
I know you have the right to do it, and I know that you do it. You bring in all sorts of materials, right?
But yeah, I think, you know, we were talking off air about how so much of the climate and the academic freedom that teachers have depends a lot on their administrator and how supportive they are of those ideas. So there's a lot of pressure from the district to do things in a certain way, to follow a certain pace and plan, and be teaching the same thing in every school across the district.
Well, because kids are always moving, right? So they have to standardize everything is the idea.
And so, what it does, though, is it hamstrings teachers to be able to be creative and meet the needs of the kids in their classroom. So things don't work at a pace. I mean, the math is like you teach a lesson every day. So if they don't get it one day and you stop and reteach and repractice, you're off the schedule. And you know, it's just like at a breakneck pace. So I think that what most teachers are dealing with is, how do I do what I know is right, what my kids need, what will engage them and excite them, and also excite me as an educator?
Yeah,
I want to be able to be creative and meet the needs of the kids
right,
in my
and
class.
And help them use what they're learning. You have to embed it in real activities,
and
right?
And I think that's what people struggle and fight to do all the time. Like I said before, there's great teaching happening all over the city. I mean, through the union, I've met amazing teachers doing amazing things in their classroom. And I think that is the desire and wish of every teacher to be able to do that. But it's a constant like battle between the pressures from above and the pressures of your immediate needs of your students in your classroom.
Rachel Haynes, this has been really enlightening and interesting. This, though, has to be the end of part one of our of our conversation. And I want to thank you so far. But next week, we're going to play part two. What are teachers doing? How are they trying? What could be done in all sorts of areas? What Rachel Haynes does is try desperately to actually teach kids, many of whom are really troubled and have trouble concentrating. And what she does is try and develop really engaging curriculums and developing ideas and developing social skills, in particular in second grade. It's really a enlightening to look at the site to see what a teacher, what a good teacher tries to do, and how you try and discuss it with parents and children and the classroom. We'll do that next week.
Yeah.
Rachel Haynes, thanks a lot for talking to us
today.
Oh,
thank you, Bill.
When some loud bragger tries to put me down and says his school is great, I tell him right away, now what's the matter, buddy? Ain't you heard of my school? It's number one in the state.
Hey, hey, take it away! Get
so
that ball
and
fight!
To your school.
Why not? The Beach Boys, Be True to Your School. And this is KBOO Portland. You're listening to the OMO Variety Hour. As Bill reported, part two of his interview with Rachel Haynes airs next Monday, when they'll be discussing the pedagogy of the three second grade classes at her mostly middle class school, but with lots of real troubled students, yet still managed to sufficiently satisfy the various corporate education requirements. But now, Joe Clement and Kevin Duggan start a series of conversations about political education, introducing the vowel-laden union acronym AEIOU, Agitate, Educate, Inoculate, Organize, and Union.
I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm joined again today by my friend, Kevin Duggan. Thanks for coming on the show, Kevin.
Hey, Joe. Thanks for having me.
We're going to inaugurate a series of conversations that we want to have over the summer about political education and organizing. Today, we're going to talk about a pretty common rubric among unions for organizing workplaces. It's called AEIOU. They all stand for different concepts. And we're going to connect those over the summer to larger themes around organizing for social change. So, Kevin, could you just go over what AEIOU stands for?
So, AEIOU is Agitate, Educate, Inoculate, Organize, Union.
And these standalone concepts work as part of a whole process. Is something that happens when we have a conversation with a coworker or another person in our community, but they also are these things that we kind of return to at different moments in the organizing process.
So at the basic level, it's used as an acronym to structure an organizing conversation. So an organizing conversation would be an intentional conversation that you have with your coworker, community member, to start to build a union or an organization. And so that's the structure that you have to sort of follow to get into stuff.
And so let's just kind of go through each of these concepts and talk about why they're important and how they work together. Agitating. Why would you say we need to start with agitating?
Agitating, that's finding out what the issues are. That's finding out what someone cares about. Because the first start of like any sort of real political education is connecting like someone's real life experience with broader political issues. And so, you know, agitation is that process.
And what would you call education?
Education, that's saying what would happen if everyone was on the same page. You know, how would things change if we all cared about this issue? So it's bringing, you know, a sense of like collective action in sort of in theory of, you know, what could we do if we had collective bargaining rather than just like you as an individual talking to your boss.
And inoculating, that isn't a word you usually hear. What does that have to do with organizing?
Inoculate is after you've gone through this other process, is prompting someone to think about what to expect when they start organizing, what to expect from their coworkers, what to expect from their boss.
And then the last two, organizing and unionizing.
Organizing is a call to action. So that's once you've done all this stuff, that is getting someone to, you know, take action. You know, the first step, talk to your coworkers.
And so this is what I and we mean by political education, is this understanding of how to build power through relationships, through information that we share in our relationships, and ultimately through taking practical steps and practical action together.
Yeah, I think that's the point, is that it's connecting both the information with the action and situating it in someone's real lived experience and in the, you know, work life, their personal life. Because politics is not an abstract concept. It's something that happens in your day-to-day life.
So agitating, that it's not just complaining. It's about trying to get people to open up, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's like sort of three main steps to agitating. Getting someone's stories, getting someone to talk about their experience, you know, in a workplace, in a house, in their community, and then really getting them to talk about it. And then once you start people start talking about it, asking specific questions to create a sense of urgency around those issues.
And then educating is, you know, it can be this involved process, but in a nutshell, it's about, you know, kind of giving the idea of the union collective power game plan, that if we all understand our issues in the same or similar way and we understand how we can be working together, then we have a chance of changing what's our problem.
Right. Yeah. No, that's, I think you said it really well. It's, you know, sort of connecting the dots that you're not an individual in this. You know, it's not just about you. It is about you know, your social group, your workplace, and that you, if you act alongside of people, then you can make changes that you could not do as an individual.
At some point, that is eventually having conversations with people about history too, about how things have been done before and they can be done again.
I think setting it up as history as a process in motion, that it's not this thing that just happened in the past, and that it's not these machinations of leaders and elites, that history is something that happens through, you know, collective action, through people agitating and getting people to sort of think about that and realize that, and realize that it's not abstract, that it's them, that it's their, they are part of that process to start to shift that, where things go.
Mm-hmm. And inoculating becomes so important, because once you get people's anxieties and concerns raised, you know, they've already been conditioned to think about them in a certain way, to package them, to say that nothing can be done, or that certain bad things are going to happen and that there's nothing can be done about that. Inoculating is this point in these conversations where we kind of invite people to kind of try on situations, to desensitize them to what's scary, or to make them familiar so that when they happen, they're not caught off guard.
Yeah, absolutely. It's prompting someone to think about, when you organize a union, what's your boss going to say? You know, how's your employer going to respond if you guys all show up together and say you want to have a union? It's really important to not lie to people, to not short sell people, to say that, you know, this isn't going to be easy necessarily. You know, there's going to be resistance, or, you know, to your coworkers even, you know, like, how are they going to respond? You know, what barriers are you going to, you know, experience with them? To set people up for the call to act, or for the call to action, so that when those things happen, they're prepared for it.
Right. And then the call to action is kind of self-explanatory, but it can be, you know, asking people to go through the process of what you have done with that person, of talking to them about their issues and getting them to understand the potential of collective power. But it can also be, once you have a group of people going, it can be about delegating more specific tasks to be inclusive.
Sure. Having a conversation with your coworkers. Another, you know, very simple example is, you know, signing a petition, showing up to an event, some sort of taking a survey, some sort of concrete material, like action, that sort of reinforces that entire conversation and makes it real and gets things moving forward.
And then the union part of that is really just kind of like signifying the culmination of this process. Once you are doing organizing, you are doing union.
Yeah. It's like the all these things added together equal union.
Well, that's all the time that we have for this initial conversation we're going to have about political education and what union organizing can teach us about building power for our social movements. later this summer, we're going to dive into each of these concepts and kind of flesh them out with more examples and thinking through the nuance of how they actually are applied, but also stressing the importance that this is a group effort and that, you know, you may start out as an individual, but your first order of business is to be building your committee, and we'll be talking about like how you identify leaders and people who will cooperate with you in that initial process.
Yeah, really it's the political education element of it is that it's collective, that it's a process, that it's not something that's a single event, as people might often think of union organizing as winning an election and then that's it. But it's actually part of a larger ongoing process that's kind of cyclical, that you get a group of people together, do an action, and then sort of repeat and build and grow and expand.
For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Joe Clement
and Kevin Dugan.
Good memories are forever, said the dog on the tombstone. If you're living underneath the bridge, man, all roads lead to home. I got a hidden flask, I'm paid in cash, got a cross above my bed. You know, I hitchhiked from Chicago, and a man walked up and said, this is a union town, all down the line. This is a union town, all down the line. And if you come to strip our rights away, we'll give you hell every time. This is a union town, all down.
And this is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. The song was Uniontown by Tony Morello, formerly of Rage Against the Machine. Why isn't the climate crisis big news on the mainstream news media? Why does our government remain blasé in the face of this crisis? How can they largely continue to ignore the biggest threat to humanity of our time, or perhaps of any time? Today I'm sharing an article entitled, As the World Burns, Hurtling Towards an Unlivable Planet by Paul Street, that explains this seemingly criminal negligence. The media and the political establishment, Street begins, are diddling while the planet burns. Are we really supposed to take their game seriously as humanity veers ever more dangerously off the environmental cliff? In 2008, James Hansen, the head of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, and seven other leading climate scientists reported that we could see practically irreversible ice sheet and species loss if the planet's average temperature rose above 1 degree Celsius, thanks to carbon dioxide's presence in the atmosphere, reaching 450 parts per million. CO2 was at 385 parts per million when this report came out in 2008. It was already in the dangerous zone, Hansen and his team reported. They warned that deadly self-reinforcing feedbacks could be triggered at this level. The dire prospects presaged included ice sheet disintegration, vegetation migration, and greenhouse gas release from soils, tundra, or ocean sediments. The only way to be assured of a viable climate, Hansen and his colleagues warned, would be to cut CO2 to at least 350 parts per million. Here we are, 11 years later, well past Hansen's 1 degree centigrade red line. We've gotten there at 410 parts per million, the highest level of CO2 saturation in 800,000 years. The United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, their latest climate report reflects the consensus opinion of the world's leading climate scientists. It tells us that we are headed to 1.5 degrees Celsius in a dozen years. Failure to dramatically slash greenhouse gassing between now and 2030 is certain to set off catastrophic developments for hundreds of millions of people, the IPCC warns. The IPCC finds that we are headed at our current pace for 3 to 4 degrees centigrade by the end of the century. That will mean a planet that is mostly unlivable. And here's the kicker. Numerous serious climate scientists find that the IPCC's findings are insufficiently alarmist and excessively conservative. That's because the IPCC deletes and downplays research demonstrating the likelihood that irreversible climatological turning points will arrive soon. Among many reports pointing in this direction is a recent NASA-funded study warning that the unexpectedly rapid thawing of permafrost could release massive volumes of CO2 and methane within a few decades. Conservative though it may be, the UN report is no whitewash. It calls for unprecedented challenges in all aspects of society to drop global CO2 emissions 45% below 2010 levels and 60% below 2015 levels by 2030. We need to hit zero by the mid-century point, the IPCC says. We cannot do that without radically and rapidly reducing our energy consumption. In remotely decent and intelligent society, public and political elites and leaders and the dominant media and politics called political culture could be fervently focused first and foremost on this problem. The climate catastrophe, climate change, is too mild a term to capture the real crisis of capitalogenic global warming, is the biggest issue of any time. As environmental blogger Robert Scribler wrote 4 years ago, there is no greater threat presented by another nation or set of circumstances that supersedes what we are now brazenly doing to our environment and the Earth system as a whole. And the rate at which we are causing the end level of damage to increase is practically unthinkable. Each further year of inaction pushes us deeper into that dangerous future. If the global warming cataclysm already significantly underway in vast swaths of the planet isn't averted soon, then nothing else we care about is going to matter all that much. We'll just be arguing about how to fairly slice up a badly overheated pie, how to turn an overcooked world upside down or right side up, and how to properly manage a living hell. You'd hardly know this from the reigning U.S. media and political culture, where the climate crisis and other critical environmental issues are pushed to the margins of public discussion. It is chilling, no ironic pun intended, to behold. With every passing fossil fuel day, the specter of man-made ecological calamity looms ever closer and larger. Climate catastrophe, television advertisers, and hence news broadcasters, are not real excited about that story. It's not a big seller of cars, petroleum products, petroleum, mutual funds, investment advice, drugs, cruise packages, and insurance policies at NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, and CNN. Even if it did sell well, the climate story doesn't line up well with corporate advertisers' carbon-caked balance sheets. By contrast, the ongoing Trump, Russia, Cohen, Manafort, WikiLeaks, Stone, Stormy, and others soap opera has been a ratings boon. And now we have the 2020 presidential candidate extravaganza, the quadriennial electoral spectacle coming onto commercial line. It's the world's greatest reality show, with the imperial presidency as the ultimate Big Brother prize. I'm not saying that all of what the mainstream media and politicians talk about is silly or insignificant, but nothing matters more now than the existential environmental crisis we face, with the climate disaster in the lead. There's no chance for social justice, democracy, equality, creativity, art, love, and community, or anything else, including profits, on a dead planet. Yes, the Green New Deal, advocated by a cadre of progressive Democrats, has made its way into media coverage and commentary in recent months. It appears that the GND, which includes welcome calls for net zero U.S. carbon emissions by 2030, will be part of at least the primary election story, thanks to Bernie Sanders, Alexandria Cortez-Ocasio, Jay Inslee, and other progressive or progressive-sounding Democrats. But don't expect it to receive all that much attention, much less positive attention, in the dominant corporate media politics complex. Serious discussion of the climate issue and environmental questions more broadly doesn't serve broadcasters' and advertisers' bottom-line interests. There's little chance that the climate crisis will remotely approach the Trump investigations and the already emergent 2020 presidential horse race when it comes to garnering real media attention. The reigning political and media elite is happy to keep capitalogenic global warming on the public margins until long past the last ecological tipping points are passed. They can be counted on to fiddle and diddle through the species' final fossil fuel flameout. It is an existential necessity to create a new culture, media, and politics with the elementary natural and social intelligence required to properly prioritize the most pressing problems of our time. That was an article entitled As the World Burns, Hurtling Towards an Unlivable Planet by Paul Street. Paul Street is a leading left author, social critic, and political commentator, his work appearing weekly in Counterpunch and Truthdig. The article can be found on the web in multiple formats simply by searching his title, As the World Burns. Paul Street's latest book is They Rule, the 1% versus Democracy. Well, while the government and the mainstream press remain silent, some young people are demanding action. We conclude our program today with another segment of our Left in the Law series. Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker give us an update on the Juliana versus United States government case, the civil lawsuit filed by 17 youth in Oregon against the U.S. government. The case argues that government inaction on the climate crisis is depriving upcoming generations of a livable future. Jan and Mike talk about a hearing coming up this week in Portland to hear oral arguments on the case. Dan and Mike.
The Giuliana versus United States lawsuit began in 2015 when our Children's Trust, an Oregon nonprofit representing kids from across the country, filed suit in a federal court. Well, Mike, we've covered the Giuliana case as it has survived a series of federal challenges and aggressive efforts by both the Obama and Trump administrations and fossil fuel industry to have the lawsuit dismissed. But the plaintiffs and their supporters have prevailed, and the case has survived these challenges. And they are at a critical crossroad this week with the stage set for a new test of their case in court here in Portland tomorrow, whether the case should continue to trial. Mike, let's start with a summary of the basis of the suit before moving to what's at stake with this ruling by three judges tomorrow.
Well, Jan, the case claims that through the government's affirmative action, they've caused climate change that has violated the youngest generation's constitutional rights to life, liberty, and property. So it's a Fifth Amendment case based on the fact that you cannot deprive anyone of their life, their liberty, their property, without due process of law. It's all very abstract, but the plaintiffs are chosen from different parts of this country and have actually suffered either lung damage or having their housing washed away by rising seas. It's very concrete damage that they've suffered. And they argue, being young, that climate change is moving, accelerating at such a pace that their quality of life will be seriously eroded unless action is done to stop it. And Judge Ann Aiken in the District Court of Oregon in Eugene found that she has no doubt that the right to a climate system capable of sustaining human life is fundamental to a free and ordered society. So she allowed a trial to proceed.
This was now almost 2 years ago, right? Her first ruling in favor of the plaintiffs.
Yes. So the government freaked out at the prospect of having to actually go to a trial, which would mean that plaintiffs would be able to discover all sorts of things about fossil fuel leases, that they would be able to present experts on all the various aspects of climate change, that the whole question of does climate change exist, and secondly, how much of it is caused by people. Are we really in a new Anthropocene age where human behavior is what's shaping our climate? These matters would all be up for grabs at a factual determination.
The vastness of the issue is both a strength of the suit and its Achilles heel, right? Because the government's pleas to have it dismissed are based on, first, that this is a global issue that far exceeds the actions of the United States government, that these are plaintiffs that have very general complaints that are not particular enough to give them standing, and that the remedy exceeds what the federal government could do and would impose unreasonable burdens on the government. That, as I understand it, those are the basis of the government's argument to have it dismissed. So what's the response to those arguments?
Well, the first response is that the fact that the government is not solely responsible does not mean that it does not play a significant part. And for example, last February, the Giuliana plaintiffs tried to get a court order preventing the federal government from issuing leases and mining permits for extracting coal on federal public lands, or tried to stop them from issuing leases for offshore oil and gas exploration and extraction activities. And they tried to keep them from granting approval for new fossil fuel infrastructure.
Which was also a way of establishing the government as a major player.
Yeah, so they're saying the fact that the government is not solely responsible does not mean that it does not play a significant part.
There's a longstanding recognition of the law of degrees of responsibility, right?
Yeah. So the government has tried three petitions for writ of mandamus. They're trying to get an interlocutory appeal.
Now, can you explain what an interlocutory appeal is? It doesn't sound like a good thing.
Well, it's something that courts usually don't like at all. Like if you have a criminal trial and there's an evidentiary ruling against you where they're going to let in a bunch of lies and you want to appeal that evidentiary ruling by the court, you can't do it. You have to wait until the whole thing is over. And at that point, any objections to judicial rulings can be made on an appeal. And courts have long disfavored interlocutory appeals, which are nothing more than an appeal done before everything is over, like halfway through. So Judge Aiken granted them an interlocutory appeal, which is unusual. So that's
granted the federal government?
Yeah, the right to do this appeal. She denied their efforts to first dismiss the case, then she denied their motions for summary judgment and a judgment on the pleadings. After the government failed in its effort to dismiss, they wanted the judge to go ahead and rule. You decided on the basis of the paper. They want desperately to avoid both the whole discovery process and a lengthy evidence
to bring it
hearing.
To a short conclusion, if not dismiss it. Is that what you're
right.
saying? Are you saying that there was one decision she made in favor of the Trump administration?
She allowed them to appeal. She did not make any ruling in their favor, but she did allow them to go to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And that is who will be hearing the case tomorrow. The Giuliani plaintiffs have generated a tremendous interest, and the hearing will be held at the Pioneer Courthouse in downtown Portland at a beautiful old building. Very small building, but they want to mob it. They want people to be in the house. They want them to be in the halls. They want them to be outside.
And there'll be a big gathering place at Director's Park at the end of the park blocks with, I think, monitors showing or screens where you can see the proceedings.
And you can see the proceedings because now every oral argument in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals is streamed live. You can watch it on YouTube. You can plug into the Ninth Circuit, or you can go to the Giuliani Children's Trust website, and they've got a link. So it won't be hard to be able to actually watch what's happening tomorrow at 2 p.m.
So if you were one of the three judges, what would be the most difficult part of the decision for you?
Well, the sheer scope of it, you know, but they've done such a masterful job, I think.
The plaintiffs have in putting together these briefs or arguments in their favor.
Yeah, like the standing is a big one. Why should these particular people be allowed to go to court and sue for climate change? You know, why can't you and I do it? And there are strict rules about who's allowed to go to court. You've got to have a very direct personal interest. Like, obviously, if you're accused of a murder and you're being tried for a death penalty, you have a great interest, so there's no issues of standing.
But with civil suits, the threshold or bar is less high than for criminal cases. Is that right?
If there's a flood, for example, in Portland and your house is washed away, then you've got real damage that you can point to. But the plaintiffs have done a very persuasive job of showing for each of their 17 plaintiffs, these people have been directly affected by what is quite likely to be climate change. Now, there are arguments against the damages they've suffered being caused by climate change, and further arguments that even if they were caused by climate change, it was not due to anything the federal government did. But the fact that they did suffer damage and their initial standing claims are pretty strong.
So are you saying that that's the main dilemma before these judges is the issue of standing, or is issue whether the federal government's responsibility and the basis of its pleas?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. They're claiming this is too nebulous and fuzzy and huge and enormous.
And would put too big a burden on the discovery phase would put too big a burden on the government. That's a big argument, too.
Well, everyone always says that. It's always a burden to have to show up somewhere else and be grilled by people under oath, penalty of perjury. I mean, who wants to do that? So everyone complains.
The judges are used to hearing that.
I know. That's not a powerful point. And what plaintiffs have tried steadily to do and have done pretty effectively is to tailor their requests to just the sorts of things that I mentioned earlier. The federal government does allow leases. Now, do they charge money for that? How do they arrive at that fund? Are they including any funds for externalities, all the damage that the smoke will cause? Are they really trying to get money at all? Are they effectively subsidizing? There's all kinds of factual questions where we could find that it's be possible that the federal government is, in fact, subsidizing the use of a poisonous environment. And if they can show that with these details, with these particular leases, they can point to significant effects. And then the issue becomes, well, how significant? Even if this does pollute the air, this is a long way from where you are. But we're getting down to finer points. which are exactly where plaintiffs want to go.
And if this goes forward to trial, the trial will be here in...
It'll be in Eugene.
In Oregon, in Eugene. In closing, what's the importance of public support? I mean, this case has mobilized interest among youth in the climate movement around the world, and press conferences were held on Saturday in countries around the world, and so it's a big stage with a lot of a very big audience. What's the importance of for the case itself and those making these rulings to see that show of support tomorrow?
Well, as Tom said in the article by Paul Street, this issue is one of deep concern to certain people, like teenagers, who don't have much to say about how the media rolls. And it's not an issue that has done much to slow down the horse race gambling and coverage. So what it does, what they're hoping, is to have the greatest viewing audience ever for a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal argument and have a large showing and to have it become, like the Green New Deal, a front page issue. It was on page one of the Los Angeles Times today. They are getting momentum, and I encourage everybody to tune in to the oral argument to see what and to show up if you're in Portland.
Which is at 2 o'clock tomorrow, and there's a website where you can learn more about the case. Well, there's Our Children's Trust and All Eyes on Juliana. There's quite a bit of information for people who want to follow it. But if you can, show up tomorrow at Director's Park or at the courthouse, Director's Park at by 2 p.m., and that's when the case opens, is that right, in the court?
Yeah, that's when they'll begin.
Mm-hmm.
I should add that the Children's Trust has a remarkably good website. It has every amicus brief. It's got a timeline. Anything and everything that you would like to know about how this case developed, about the people who are the plaintiffs, is there on their website, easily accessible.
Yeah, they've done a remarkable job in that way and sustaining the commitment to this over time. Something to behold and to support. And it kind of puts Oregon in a spotlight in a good way as well in terms of the importance of this case globally. And that they're not just, you know, an isolated group of young heroes, but they're part of a larger global movement and many organizations working around climate justice and addressing the race and class aspects of this issue, what Native Americans call the sacrifice zones, places where indigenous communities are already feeling the worst and most severe effects of climate change. So it's not just something down the road.
That's right. These are the plaintiffs. And this case has become the point of the spear. And that I was very surprised to see the Los Angeles Times had a page one story on this very case.
Okay, so this is Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker talking today about the Juliana versus United States government lawsuit on their not only failure to act on climate change, but their active participation in the destruction of the planet itself. And we encourage everyone to be out there tomorrow in support of in this incredibly important juncture in the road for this case. And we'll continue to follow it.
And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patricia Kohlberg has been our engineer. Thanks to all participants today, Bill Resnick and Rachel Haynes on public schools, Joe Clement and Keith Dugan on the need for political education, and our Left in the Law commentators, Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker, on the Oregon youth who are suing the U.S. government over its failure to address the climate crisis. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the Mole's point of view. That is, from the ground up. As Moles, we seek to explore alternative possibilities for our culture, social, and political lives that move beyond the hegemony of unfettered global capitalism and a culture of consumerism, exploitation, and environmental devastation. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission.